This interview of Wisdom from the Top was recorded in 2020. From Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, the story of Jeff Jones, president and CEO of H&R Block.
It's about transparency. It's about trust. It's about speed, sharing of information. And so even when it's a hard message, I've just found the more I can say it and people can hear it directly, it's really the only thing I know how to do.
How a young man from West Virginia named Jeff Jones went from being an ad guy to the CEO of one of America's top tax prep companies. Jeff Jones knows crisis. He was a top executive at Target during the 2013 data breach. He was the president of Uber during a tumultuous period that would end with the departure of its founder. And today, he's the head of H&R Block, the biggest tax preparation company in the U.S., right in the middle of a global economic meltdown. This is a moment in history that will test every single leader. And Jeff Jones says how leaders respond will also be the measure by which they are judged in the future. Jeff never intended to run a Fortune 1000 company. At the beginning, he was an ad guy. He grew up in West Virginia. Both of his parents ran a variety of small businesses. At one point, restaurants, tanning salons, even a nightclub with a lighted dance floor and mechanical bull. And when Jeff was a junior in high school, his parents lost everything. Their business went bankrupt, and they struggled to get back on their feet.
They scrapped and borrowed some money from friends, and that's when they relaunched into this video rental business and actually built a little chain of stores in West Virginia and in Ohio. My dad got to the point several years into that where he sold the business, and it's a really tragic story because he sold business to a friend, did classic owner financing of the business, and that person really struggled in ownership and committed suicide. And my parents got the business back after it had almost been run into the ground. And so then they had to kind of pick themselves up again, and ultimately over a few years were able to sell off pieces and parts and finally left with one store, and then they were finally able to sell that one store as well.
Wow. So, I mean, from an early age, you learned the ups and downs of what it means to run a business. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Which must have, I guess, in a sense, and unbeknownst to you at the time, prepared you for a life of the inevitable ups and downs in the business world. So you went on to the University of Dayton in Ohio, where you studied communications. What was your thinking that you would kind of like be a comms guy or an ad guy?
You know, it was. I had an internship every single year of college or work every summer between colleges. And I developed this passion for advertising because it was this combination of business, psychology, human behavior. But because of where I grew up, I was terrified of going to New York, which is where everyone thought they had to go to work in advertising. I was afraid of the big city. So I set my sights on Chicago and the biggest and best firm there called Leo Burnett. And I started applying in college and just kept getting rejection letter after rejection letter. I literally put all of them on my mirror in college and wrote "do not quit" on them. I still have those letters, by the way.
Wow.
I still have all of them. I kept that folder.
Wow. Good for you.
It's amazing to look back. I moved to Chicago without a job, and I basically knocked on the door of Leo Burnett so much they gave me an informational interview, and I'll never forget it. The guy that interviewed me sat in his chair in a rocking chair, had plaid pants, and he said, "I have basically two questions for you. The first question is, tell me about the last time somebody said to you, that's a great idea." And I gave him an example, and he said, "Give me another." And I gave him an example, and he said, "Give me another." And he just kept saying, "Give me another," until I was exhausted. And he said, "The point of that is, this is an idea business. And I just wanted to see how vulnerable you would be with sharing bad ideas. He said, my second question is, tell me about a product that does not exist, but should exist. And I have no idea. On the spot, I said, fingernail clippers that catch your fingernails. And I got hired by Leo Burnett after that interview. Wow. And then was immediately moved to Detroit to start my career.
And did you like it? Was it interesting work?
It was very interesting work. You know, you're given original problems all the time. You are hired to be original all the time. By definition, there's no scale in the idea business. And I loved it. And you asked me this question, and it's actually really important the way you said it to me. I was working on the P&G business as an account guy, and there was a very Procter and Gamble. And there was a very senior person there who pulled me aside one day and said, do you want to be an ad guy or do you want to be a marketer? And it was a really important moment in my career because she helped me think about the difference between those two things. And that conversation prompted me to leave Leo Burnett to join the Coca-Cola company in my first job as a corporate marketer.
Wow. So you go off to Coca-Cola and you sort of begin to transition from quote unquote being an ad guy to learning about marketing. And what was the difference? What did you realize the difference was?
You know, I think there's a few differences. Of course, there's the difference of being in an agency versus being in a corporate environment and all the differences that come with that. But I think the biggest difference is just the breadth of what marketing really means when you step back and think about pricing strategy, product development, distribution, and then marketing communications as the advertising piece. But, you know, suddenly you're thinking about all the different ways to, at Coca-Cola, we were trained by Sergio Zeman. He said, to get more people to buy more of your stuff, more of the time at higher prices. And that's literally how the Coca-Cola marketers were taught in the mid-90s.
Presumably that's changed. That approach has changed today.
It would have to have changed.
Yeah.
No
yeah,
doubt.
Right.
No doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know that you were at Coke for a couple of years, and then you got recruited back to Leo Burnett, where you stayed, and then you helped them for a few years. But then you kind of take a big leap into the corporate world. In 2004, you were recruited to become the CMO at Gap. And this was at a time when Gap was kind of struggling a little bit, right? I mean, it was sort of, I don't know, trying to get its bearings back.
Yeah. I think it was the beginning of what's become now a, you know, decade plus long struggle for the company. And I was there. I was working in the Gap brand as the chief marketing officer, part of an entirely new leadership team that was brought in. And in about 2 years, that entire leadership team, including me, was either fired or given new jobs. So here I am now in San Francisco, chief marketing officer for the Gap. And the entire team I joined has been blown up. And so now it's time to change chapters again. Thank goodness I had these parents we talked about earlier.
Yeah, right. I mean, the Gap is a clean and simple, you know, classic American apparel brand, but obviously struggled and continues to struggle, and in this new current climate, probably will struggle even more. What was your sort of mandate? I mean, your mandate presumably was to reignite the brand. How are you thinking about doing that through marketing? What was your strategy going to be?
It's interesting that, you know, the challenge is always growth. And then how do you drive growth? And, you know, in that case, we thought it's a lot about relevance of the brand, contemporary relevance. I traveled all over the world and I always had people say to me, oh, I love Gap. I remember when. And it was always a story of the past. So, you know, great kind of latent built up love, but no current purchase.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I believed and ultimately the team believed was Gap's problem wasn't it needed better advertising. So it's not a marketing communications problem. It's a product relevance problem and a retail experience problem. And we took a very, very bold step in my tenure there. Denver, Colorado was a particular market where we closed every single Gap store. We remodeled every single Gap store, retrained every associate, and relaunched the brand based on an entirely new shopping experience. Many of those ideas live on today, but we just believed that we couldn't advertise our way out of the problem. Everyone knew Gap, but if our physical experience didn't get better and more compelling, we didn't have a chance. So even though what we did in Denver, you know, in quotes, worked, meaning it drove more traffic and more sales, it wasn't possible to replicate other places, too expensive. That combined with the portfolio in Gap Inc. of brands like Old Navy, really competing for the same family, same customer, you know, it just became clear that there was a portfolio positioning challenge and a cost model at Gap that we just couldn't overcome.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like, and we're talking 2004, 2006, right?
That's
sounds
right.
Like, I think I'm foreshadowing a bit, that you were really observing and kind of absorbing the lessons that you were being exposed to, that you could sort of see that there were some really good ideas on the table, but for some reason they weren't working, and you were already starting to try and figure out why that was the case.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's exactly right. And like any problem, and I think in retail especially, you have product, you have relevance, you have physical, you have digital. There's a lot of dynamics. There's usually not one thing. And so we tried a very holistic approach, but again, it was too expensive to scale. And then that started becoming you know, we're cutting back what we're doing. And, you know, Paul Pressler left the company and a series of management turnovers once again.
You would eventually leave as well. What was the biggest takeaway from your time at Gap? What was the lesson that you feel like you learned from there that you would be able to apply in the future?
There's no question, you know, it's this whole idea about how important it, especially in those cases, you have to make big changes. And if you don't make big changes, then the people that are making the change feel like you're doing a lot, but the consumer doesn't notice.
Yep.
You know, it's as the creator of change, people are terrified to do things in a big, bold, dramatic way. But if you don't do that, the consumer doesn't notice anything's different.
And if the consumer doesn't notice, it's like a tree falling in a forest with no one around, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, we learned this very, very clearly at Target.
Well, let's talk about Target. I know we're missing a big gap of time here, but let's talk about Target, because you would eventually go on to join Target and become the chief marketing officer there, which was you were there at a very, you know, interesting and dramatic time. So yeah, tell us the story.
Well, interesting and dramatic, there's no question, was my era at Target.
And you moved to Minneapolis.
I moved to Minneapolis, that's right.
Got it.
And, you know, at Target, I helped us navigate through the data breach, closing down a failed Canadian expansion, mm-hmm. A very traumatic time that in hindsight seems small, but not at the moment, where we had a lot of issues with people thinking you could bring your assault weapons to a Target store. That created a major crisis. The transgender bathroom topic, which became a major crisis for the company. So navigating through really big crises at a very, very big company. But we were also transforming. We were digitizing the business. We were changing physical retail. And the story is, if you've been in a Target store, you know, when you walk in, there's a place at the beginning of the store that Target calls Bullseye's Playground. And this is a place where all moms and families stop. It's, you know, inexpensive items and lots of things that kids love.
That right area, when you come in, yep.
Correct, yep. Right when you come in. And that area of the store needed reinvented. It was not performing like it should. So, you know, big companies do what they do. Teams are dedicated. We study the problem, all kinds of ideas. And the basic idea was We're going to turn the gondolas so all the shelves go from 90-degree angles to 45-degree angles. And this will change the shopping pattern. It will feel new and fresh when you walk in.
Got it.
And we change the product a bit. But the point of all this is teams are sweating and grinding over this massive change we're going to make.
Yeah.
And I remember coming home to my wife, who was, you know, in Target almost every day, saying, "What'd you think?" "What are you talking about? Like, did you notice, like, when you walk in the Bullseye's playground, we changed everything." He's like, "What are you talking about?"
Yeah.
And it was that reminder that all the energy that went into making this change, nobody noticed.
Yeah.
And then we literally said, "Now let's reinvent it." We rebranded it Bullseye's Playground. We put incredible merchandising of Bullseye the dog everywhere. We changed the product assortment. And now it was an entirely new experience that the consumer noticed, and performance completely changed.
It's so interesting because so many businesses, right? This is a story that I'm sure everyone listening can relate to. Teams gather around and there's arguments and there's conversations and intense discussions, and then it's agreed after weeks and weeks that we're going to move the the shelving units by 40 to 45 degree angles, and then no one notices, right?
Correct.
And it's a little bit like what happened at Gap, which is there was all this discussion and effort and with the, you know, revamping the stores and whatever, customers didn't really notice the changes, right? And it sounds like that didn't really move the needle. What you had to do was actually put better, cooler products in there and promote it, let people know that this was a thing.
Correct. And to Target's credit, that was the beginning of the massive investment they have made. And I've lost track now, but it's in the ballpark of, you know, $5 to $10 billion investing back in physical stores. And they took a holistic approach. The changes have been dramatic. And their business has been on fire. And so that's actually a really good example of big, bold change and understanding your customer and how it can work.
Stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. Welcome back to Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. I mean, you know, Target is managed to kind of be the cool big box store, right? Like, there's obviously Walmart and there's, you know, competitors out there, but Target is the, you know, it's got the, you know, the different product lines from kind of cool and interesting designers, and it's got the layout of the store is very clear and straightforward. When you got there and you started to make these changes, I guess, what was going on? Like, it was kind of in a weird place, right? I mean, Target was not performing as well as it should have been.
That's right. That's right. You know, I joined at the beginning of an era when most of the things Target sold were exactly what you said: interesting, cool, what we call differentiated products. But they're not things you buy every day. Mm. And so in order to solve the business problem of getting more frequency, Target made the decision to move into grocery and more household items.
Yeah, right.
And when it did that, you're now competing with an entirely different set of stores. And in simple terms, what we said and what we recognized was we were trying to be somebody else instead of being a better Target. And the whole idea of expect more, pay less is who Target is. But we were in an era where we had forgotten that. The data breach caused all kinds of reflection. And that company did not waste that crisis, you know, to use the expression,
yeah,
and rethought of everything. And in that moment, in crisis, in the data breach, we get a new CEO, Brian Cornell, who's there now.
Yep.
And we
yep.
said, we have to get back to who we are at our best. And since that moment, Brian has led that company to execute that incredibly well.
He was on the show last season. I want to talk about the data breach. This is, at the time, I think one of the largest data breaches in corporate history. And you were sort of asked to kind of co-lead you know, the recovery with the company's chief legal counsel. And it was a huge problem for Target, and I'm sure a crisis moment. And at that time, there was an article, I think it was in Gawker or something, and it was anonymously quoted a Target employee from corporate headquarters who was really kind of criticizing the company's response. And you actually wrote a blog post on LinkedIn called Truth Hurts.
That's right.
Where you were just really just kind of like, this is what's going on. This is really, it's bad. And we're going to try and make this right. What was that like a planned thing? Did you have like big discussions with your team about doing this? Was it, tell me about that response.
Oh my gosh, it gives me chills thinking about that moment. I mean, it's really hard to describe what it was like at Target at that moment, because it wasn't the biggest data breach ever, but it quickly became the most well-known data breach. Yeah. And people were furious at the company. And again, because of Target's connection to its guest, it hit home in a very personal way. Every day on the news, the headlines every single night was Target won't recover, Target's dead, the stock was getting decimated, the CEO was fired, most of the leadership team ultimately was fired. I mean, it was absolute hair on fire panic every day. And there was a moment where we were in between CEOs, and myself and a couple other colleagues were kind of brought together to, you know, co-lead the company through this. And when that article was written, and keep in mind, in that day, every single day was a media crisis.
I bet, yeah.
I literally went home that night. This is no exaggeration. I sat down with my laptop and in almost kind of without lifting my fingers off the keys, just wrote that response. And I sent it to our head of communications, and we just said, we have to publish it. And that was it.
And for people who haven't read it, tell us what you wrote.
Well, I titled it The Truth Hurts. I acknowledged this person who had written this anonymous post. And it was really much who I was and who I am as a leader. I was known that way at Target. You know, I just think you have to talk about the things that need talked about. And so I credited this person for having the courage, even though I didn't like they did it anonymously, to raise the things that were front and center the company had to deal with. And I said, we will. And oh my gosh, if I would have known how that would have landed in the world, I probably would have been too afraid to write it. Because literally within 48 hours, every major news outlet on the planet wanted me to sit down and talk about it. And I didn't do it. And it was also an important moment where I wanted to have a conversation with this person. We obviously did it in a public way, but this wasn't about me. I didn't want this to become its own story. And so I refused to talk publicly about it. I turned down all the interviews to share the story. But it was a real seminal moment in the turnaround of the data breach, because I think what it was able to do internally was to give people the confidence that we weren't going to hide from the truth. And as a leadership team, we knew there were things that had to change and we were committed to changing them.
That it was essentially an acknowledgement of an internal failure and an acknowledgement of, we're going to make this right.
That's right. That's exactly right. Which is difficult to do in a crisis.
Yeah, but important, crucial. It's actually amazing to me that more leaders don't do this in crises. That they don't just come out very quickly and just kind of surrender and say, this is a mistake, this is a problem. We're going to make this right, but right now, we got to figure out what's going on, and we're going to do everything to make it right. But, you know, we screwed up.
That's right. I think crisis at Target really set in motion for corporate America a different way to think about the crisis response playbook. And, you know, when you're in that moment, and anybody who's in or been through crises know, in the data breach, myself and my colleague were living in the middle of this triangle. One side was litigation, one side was investigation, and one side was communication. And that is what describes what happens in crises. Your instinct is to communicate, but you don't always know the facts in real time, what's actually happening. And your attorneys, you know, rightfully so, are protecting you, saying, if you say that, that means this. And I think that's why companies get stuck, is because there's not a healthy tension on all three sides of that triangle, and one side wins. And as a result, leaders get talked out of saying what they believe needs to be said.
I know we could talk about Target for forever and ever, and there's so many lessons that we can take from that experience. But I want to get to Uber, because I know that in 2016 you met Travis Kalanick at the TED conference in Vancouver. I was there too. I remember that TED conference. And you were just, I guess, meeting him and just chatting with him and kind of giving him some informal advice about ways the company could, you know, kind of think of, you know, reestablishing itself, because it was already getting hammered by customers, consumers, by drivers. There were a lot of stories about the corporate culture there that were kind of toxic. And I guess that meeting at TED impressed them, and they kind of recruited you. They asked you to come and be the president of the company, which you accepted because it was an interesting opportunity. Like, why? Tell me what you were thinking about that. Why you were thinking about that opportunity in that way?
Well, it was after about 6 months of spending a lot of time with Travis. It did begin at Vancouver after he gave his TED talk, if you remember that talk.
Yep.
And ultimately, the decision for me was, you have an opportunity to lead one of the most important companies in history with a really clear purpose about what transportation can do to cities all around the world, and be in the epicenter of the future. And
yeah,
for everything that I loved and still love about Target, that was an opportunity I viewed to be something I couldn't say no to. But it didn't start out as a job opportunity.
It started out just kind of informally.
Correct.
Advising. Yeah.
That's right.
They were. Can I just ask you about this for a sec? Because I do want. We're going to talk about your time at Uber, but I don't know Travis personally. And I think Uber and what he created is obviously an incredible idea and product. But I remember that TED Talk. I've seen him, you know, interviewed in public forums. And he may personally be a lovely person. I don't know. I don't know him. But he really comes across, to me at least, as a kind of leader I would not want to work for when I see him, when I've seen him speak publicly before he left Uber. He's been quiet since, obviously. That there was a kind of just an arrogance and a hostility to simple things like, you know, regulation, for example, but in a very in a way that I don't know, I don't often see in other corporate leaders, you know. I wonder if you felt that way, or I mean, I don't know, was he different personally? Because if I was being recruited to work for the company, I don't know if I'd want to do it simply by my experience watching him in public.
Yeah, no, it's a great point, a great comment. I look back on my decision and ask myself the same thing sometimes. But there's no question he is one of the most brilliant people that I've ever had the chance to know. He is definitely not perfect. None of us are. He had such a clear view of the world and the role that Uber could play in changing the world. And when I ultimately decided to join, again, it was after many months of spending time together, I knew that I was coming to help him and the company, in quotes, grow up, to mature, to bring a level of, you know, I don't think, and I don't want to obviously try to guess how Travis would say it, but I don't think Travis would view himself as a corporate leader. In fact, you know, I was the corporate guy coming in.
Right.
But the mission and the scale and the importance and the role of technology was just too much for me to say no to. And I do not regret my decision to go. I don't look back with regrets at all, but obviously months in, I decided that it was the wrong place for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. Going to work for a company like Uber was going to be a hugely exciting opportunity because of what Uber is. And a lot of really smart people came in. I mean,
yes.
A lot of them came in to help out because for that very reason, that this was an opportunity to help this incredible company grow up and actually operate in a way that, you know, big companies need to operate. You were not able to kind of do what you were used to doing as a leader there because you were out of there, I think, in 6 months with many, many other leaders who joined. Was it as simple as that? I mean, was it for you? You just thought, you know, my values just don't align with what I'm seeing here, or I'm not able to apply my, you know, everything I know about leadership here. What was your experience like?
Yeah, I mean, you just summarized really what was on my mind. But, you know, it was by far one of the hardest decisions I've ever made in my life. And, you know, despite the kind of situations that I've put myself in and the change that I've driven and dealt with, here I was having just left what most people would believe is one of the best jobs on the planet to jump into this situation and try to make a difference. I'm now commuting back and forth to San Francisco, but in theory, I'm all over the world all the time. My family's still in Minneapolis. And I recognize that I'm not able to make the change I'm brought there to make. But you can't just quit. And so you find new ways and you try new things. But the pace, you know, 1 week at Uber is like a year at most companies. The absolute pace and change that happens that quickly. And so while 6 months is a very short amount of time, it wasn't without a lot of effort to try to make things different. But you reach a point where you realize that you've made a bad decision. It's the wrong place for you. It doesn't mean it's the wrong place for other people. And I did everything I could to leave there by making it clear it was about values. But the last thing the company needed at that moment in time was the president of the company leaving.
Yeah.
But I knew I had to do it. And so I did it. But my gosh, it was one of the most heart-wrenching and gut-wrenching, you know, decisions I've ever made in my life.
I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. We'll be right back. This is Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. Travis would leave shortly after you left under pressure from the board. But as president, what did you want to do that you just couldn't do? Because, you know, from the outside, you think that you're the president. You've got a lot of power.
Yeah. I mean, the basic thing that I believed, and keep in mind, I was only ride sharing. So I was not responsible for all the other business units that now exist. But it was really clear that the company needed to do two big things. Number one was we had to repair a relationship with the drivers. And number two is we had to stop prioritizing growth at all costs, both reputationally and economically. And so that became really my platform. How do we make more decisions to grow at a pace that allows the company ultimately to make money? And how do we take steps to repair our relationship with the drivers who had become incredibly, you know, disenchanted with what Uber was about? And those, you know, ultimately, you know, we were not able to do as successfully as I wanted. And you add on to that the other businesses and the importance of safety and, you know, all the other things that they're working through.
So you obviously lasted about 6 months there. And I think immediately after you stepped down, you were just recruited left and right by a bunch of different companies and eventually decided to go to H&R Block in Kansas City, where you are now the CEO. This is your first executive post. This is your first post as CEO of a big company. I'm right about that, right?
That's right. First time public CEO.
And I've been to Kansas City, and it's a great place, super cool downtown, awesome community, H&R Block, obviously one of the pillars of Kansas City. Most people think of H&R Block as a, you know, right, as like your tax preparer. You go there once a year and you use it, and then or you do it online, and that's it. When you got to H&R Block, is that sort of initially how you thought of it as well?
Without question. I was recruited from the outside. I'm not a tax guy. I'm not a financial services guy. I joke with many people that when I first got the call, I said, I have a really common name. Are you sure you got the right Jeff Jones? I thought for sure I would be staying in Silicon Valley. And so I from the outside, just looked at this company and saw an incredible brand, well-known, highly trusted, and not a financial crisis. You know, for a company our size, an incredibly profitable company. And what I described was a crisis of relevance. And what that means and continues to mean is we have to improve the quality of what we do. We have to deliver better value, and we have to be way more digitally modern in every part of the business.
So how do you make H&R Block something different, more relevant? What is it about H&R Block that gives it, makes it more interesting or something that you know, better value proposition than any other tax preparation service?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one we ask ourselves a lot. You know, when I first got here, who are we? How did we get here? Why are we here? And what role do we play in the world? And what became really clear to me after all the things you would expect a new leader to do, the, you know, 50-city listening tour with our tax pros, et cetera. No one talked to me about taxes. What became really clear was, you know, this brand is about restoring financial confidence to Main Street America. We operate in, thousands of local communities. We're the pillar of many local communities, and we are the number two online software company for DIY. So taxes are really an important part of what we do. We also do small dollar lending. We also have financial products like debit cards. We have 2.5 million small business owners who are clients for taxes or bookkeeping or payroll or other things. And so we see ourselves, you know, kind of squarely in the financial services world, but serving a part of America that needs help and turns to us to build that financial confidence every single year.
You know, it's interesting because when you think about the conversations you have with certain people in your life, some of them are quite personal. Like if you work with a lawyer. But your accountant, right? Like when I talk to my accountant about financial issues and tax issues, there's a lot of personal stuff there. You know, I'm kind of, it's almost like talking to a priest or a therapist. It's you're really kind of going through certain decisions and talking about certain things. And is this the right way to go? And what do you think? And, you know, there's a lot of trust that you place in that person. But when people just file online, you kind of lose that, right? You're not getting that personal interaction, whether it's by phone or face to face. Is that a place where H&R Block has an advantage over, you know, purely software based tax preparers?
We think we do. You know, we talk about it as our human advantage, and it's very much how we view our role in the world. You know, if you just take a step back, there are 150 million people in America that pay taxes every year, and about 55% of them get help. About 45% do taxes themselves. So in the U.S., the majority of people today in the digital world that we're in still turn to somebody for help. And the reason why, and if you just think about it as people, it makes intuitive sense. Most people say, I want to get everything I deserve, and I'm afraid I'll get in trouble if I get it wrong. And that's why people turn for help. And so what we're doing now is, if you're a DIY filer, it used to be you only had two choices, either you know, come get help or good luck, do it yourself. And now we're introducing products. We call it online assist. So bringing human help to people, whether they're DIY filers or they come to an office, is really how we think we can leverage the 80,000 person network of experts we have. We did a survey recently to DIY filers, and 40% of them said, I know I'm making mistakes when I do my taxes. I just don't know where the mistakes are.
Yeah.
And so we know that people need help, and that's what we're trying to bring.
So, Jeff, right now, you and every single leader of a big or a small organization, and even me, we're finding ourselves in a very different world, right? We're all crisis managers all of a sudden, overnight, right? I mean, you are working from home. You're talking to me from home right now instead of in the studio with me. And you know, we're all figuring out how to work with our teams remotely, how to keep our businesses running, how to do everything, because there's no playbook for this. I mean, I guess there is a playbook, 1918, but I mean, the world was very different back then, right? So first of all, I mean, the tax filing deadline has been extended, right, nationally and in most states. So tell me a little bit about how will you deal with this?
How do you deal with it?
How do you deal with it? Yeah.
Yeah. This isn't about the company. You know, what I have to do, and I think what all leaders have to do right now, is we have to make the best decisions possible with information changing hourly and know that not everybody will feel heard or satisfied. And that's what makes leadership in a crisis so hard, because you have to make decisions. You have to keep moving forward. So for us, what that's meant is, you know, we know that about 80% of our clients get a refund. So our availability is vital to get dollars flowing back into the economy. But we also know it can't be business as usual. So we've had to put in place an unprecedented set of benefits to help our associates if they can't work or are unable to work or they're impacted by the coronavirus. We have moved our tax offices nationwide to be primarily a drop-off model. In some cities, exclusively a drop-off model, and in some cities, we've closed. We're encouraging people to use our virtual products. So essentially, what we're trying to do is, you know, follow all the guidelines we're all following to keep people healthy, and try to make sure we're not cutting off people's access to refunds all at the same time. And yeah, we're making decisions daily, and we won't make perfect ones every single day.
You are, like many other leaders, finding yourself in a very new leadership role, essentially overseeing a company remotely.
Yes.
And the company that is going to be dealing with many, many financial collapses. How does your sort of leadership approach, right, and philosophy, everything that you've learned over the course of your career, you've got to muster all of it now,
yeah,
to lead in a completely new way. What guides you? What is the philosophy that you kind of lean on or think about or consider as you enter these uncharted waters?
You know, it obviously weighs on every leader right now trying to figure this out. I rely as best I can on we at H&R Block call connected leadership. And what that means is it's about transparency, it's about trust, it's about speed, sharing of information. And so even when it's a hard message, I've just found the more I can say it and people can hear it directly, it's really the only thing I know how to do.
That's Jeff Jones. He's the president and CEO of H&R Block. Jeff spoke to me from his home in Kansas City. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR.